Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will be finding common ground and taking it to the next level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. This show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. It's my hope that you will come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. Now, my guests will have differing spiritual belief systems, and some will have no spiritual beliefs. You may or may not agree with things that are said. What I'd ask you to do is keep an open mind. This way, you can see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. And today, my guest is a 70-year-long church musician by the name of William Hanley, and I will be introducing him to you after I read his biography. I just wanted to let folks know that the show is now being broadcast on Thursdays, as it is today, and also Friday at 7:30. And tomorrow night, Rob Anthony, the radio personality, will be on the show. And next Thursday at 3:30, I will have author Andrew Gray on the show. And coming up later in the month, we have a couple of best-selling authors. There's Brian McNaught and John McNeil, and also the spiritual healer Mary Blake. So it's going to be a very exciting month. And without further ado, let me read William's biography. William Hanley showed talent at age 3 by picking out tunes on the piano that he'd heard on the radio. He begged for piano lessons, but they were not forthcoming until he turned 10. Then his grandmother came up with the money to give him lessons. At age 18, he met Hetty Mela Killian, who had studied piano for the concert stage in Berlin, Germany. He began lessons with her in December 1946, and started the same as a 5-year-old beginner. He told her he wanted to become a concert pianist, and she said, "It's not going to happen. It's too late." At age 15, he was asked to become organist and cantor of his local Roman Catholic church. The pastor of the church subsequently sent him to study Gregorian chant and Renaissance choral polyphony and organ at the Pius X School of Liturgical Music in New York City. This was the finest school of its kind in this hemisphere. He is a graduate of Syracuse University, where his applied major was pipe organ and his major was music education. He then acquired a job teaching music in grades 1 through 6 in Jordan, New York. He was there for 5 years, went back to get a master's degree, and never went back to teaching in the public schools. From then on, his life was devoted to being an organist and choir director. He also attended 2 other choral schools, Fred Waring and Olaf Christiansen. His specialties today are Gregorian chant, a cappella Renaissance polyphony, and choral techniques. And so now it's my pleasure to introduce William Hanley. William, how are you today?
I'm feeling well, thank you.
Good, good. Well, I'm delighted to have you here. I thank you for agreeing to be on the show. I will be very interested in exploring your musical career, which has gone on for 70 years now. And I understand that you became interested in music at a very early age. How did that happen, Bill?
Well, I would have to say it was not of my own doing. It was just it was predetermined when I was conceived, it was already there. I'm guessing that's the case, because those kind of things are innate and they suddenly happen. And as I said, as you said before, I picked out tunes at the piano when I was three. And I do recall that sometime maybe in the following year, the story is told about me. I don't remember all these things myself, but we went to a Kresge's 5 and 10, and they had a record department going, and I danced a jig there with an audience watching me because they people were fascinated by my reaction to music at that age. And then at age 4, my parents began taking me to church, and I remember that the organist would start playing the organ, and I would sob with tears at the sound of the music. I was quite moved by those solemn sounds of the instrument.
So
that's how it all kind of began.
I see. And you had hoped to study piano at an earlier age, but you didn't get to start until age 10?
Well, I when I got into first grade, my teacher in first grade, my first grade teacher, played the piano. We used to sing songs. And she would accompany us on the piano, and I envied her, and I thought, oh, if I could play like that. Of course, I had had no lessons at all, so I was 6. And believe it or not, I still remember a song that we sang in first grade. I remember the words and the music.
What was it?
Go ahead.
What was the song?
The song? April Showers, Springtime Flowers. Listen to the rain.
Oh, yes.
Pitter-patter, pitter-patter, listen to the rain. I could even sing it for you, but I won't burden you with that.
Okay.
I asked for lessons, and it didn't happen. There was no reaction to that at all. I don't remember whether there was an explanation or what happened, but finally at 10, I must have kept begging for the next 4 years, and finally my grandmother came up with the price of the lessons, which were 50 cents an hour.
Oh, my. Okay. Can you imagine?
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. And unfortunately, that teacher was not qualified to teach a person of my talent because I had a potential to be a concert pianist, and she was not qualified to teach me in that direction. And so I ended up, as you said earlier, at the age of 18 with a good teacher and having to start out like a beginner. At 8. So that's what happened.
Yeah, that's
about
a shame.
The piano deal.
A lot of wasted potential there. Can you tell us about the most significant music teacher in your life?
Well, I've had more than one significant teacher in my life. I would say the most significant piano teacher was Hetty Killian, the one you mentioned earlier. She was concert caliber herself, and so she was significant. And then I had high school teacher that I had studied music when I was a sophomore in high school. I studied music theory and rudiments of music, and of course had to learn all the various terms for music in Italian. We had to learn 100 of them, memorize them. I had a final exam in that, got 100 in the exam. And that was when I was around 14, 15.
Mm.
And at that, then I had my organ teacher that I had in college was significant. Arthur Poister was his name, and he was a student of Marcel Dupré. And Dupré was the organist of Notre Dame in Paris. And that's not exactly small potatoes.
Not at all.
Then at the age of 14 also, when I was in high school, there was a band program, and the band director asked me what instrument I wanted to play, and I said I wanted to play the French horn. He said, well, the school has only one, and it's already taken. So all these years I pined to play the French horn. I'm taking French horn lessons now and started about a little over a year ago, and I have that's a significant teacher also, I would say.
That's wonderful that you're finally able to do that and that you were able to find a good teacher for that. I know that you've spoken very highly of him. backing up to your studies with Hetty Killian, how did it make you feel when she told you that you wouldn't ever be able to be a concert pianist?
Well, I really don't know how it made me feel at the time. I only know this. I remember this, or I can remember her telling me, I don't know whether I was writing a paper. I think I may have been writing a paper on it, on that, perhaps. I do remember she said to me, as far as in the concert field, if a person doesn't practice one day, then I'm talking about the performer now, the pianist or whatever it is. If a person doesn't practice one day, then the person notices that. I mean, the one who would be doing the practicing notices that he hasn't practiced.
Mm-hmm.
He misses 2 days, and the critics notice. He misses 3 days of practice, and the public notices, and your career is over.
Oh, my.
I can remember her telling me that.
Mm.
You know, so you hear, I've heard people say, well, so-and-so's so good they don't need to practice anymore. Nonsense. Everyone has to practice.
Well, how much did you practice when you started out lessons with her?
Well, when I started with Hetty Killian?
Yes.
Well, let me go back farther as far as practicing is concerned. Back the time when I was 12 years old, I had my first teacher who was not adequate. I practiced an hour and a half a day when I was 12 of my own volition.
Okay.
My parents, you know, they didn't have to be after me and say, well, now get your practicing done. That didn't happen. They had rather had to say, well, when are you going to stop playing? Or they didn't say that. that would be what they could say, you know, when are you going to get away from that piano?
Uh-huh.
And, of course, the other boys of my age were doing all kinds of sports and what have you. And when school was over and they were playing baseball, I went bypassed the baseball field and came home to practice because I felt that was more important.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as far as Hetty Killian, when I started with her, despite the fact that she said, you are not going to make it in the concert field, I thought, but I am going to learn to play well. And I practiced as much from 8 to 10 hours a day for one solid year after high school. I graduated from high school, never taken lessons with her, and that following year, that's all I did was piano. I didn't work any place. You know, I just did piano. 8 to 10 hours a day. I did as much as 10 hours in a day.
How far did you advance during that time period? You must have... I've heard you talk about how when you started playing with her that you were at a 5-year-old level. And
yes.
How far did you advance after all that practice for that year?
Well, I advanced to certainly at least college level.
Okay.
I got into college level. I mean, I was doing, for instance, I did the major works of Brahms and Beethoven and Mendelssohn and so on, and I did the Schumann. I did quite a bit of music of Williams or Robert Schumann, and I did his A minor piano concerto.
And this was after 1 year of study with her?
Well, there or thereabouts. I don't know that it
was
1 year. I did study with her for more than just 1 year, but for one year, all I did was piano. I studied with her after that year was up. I still continued studying for a few more years, in fact.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I just wondered with all of that practice how far you were able to advance in that year, because that's just, I play the piano too, and I've never practiced like that, so I just can't imagine how much a person can advance with that kind of practice. So I was just curious about that.
It's a sizable amount, but, you know, I don't have I can't exactly tell you where on what pieces I was playing after that year was up. I don't have that in my head. I don't remember that, just where I was. But as I say, I did do... some major works, and I did work on the Robert Schumann A minor piano concerto. I did work on that. So that's that's concert material. That's concert material. Yeah. But I never played it with an orchestra. She played it. She had two pianos. She had two Steinway pianos, and she would play the orchestral part on her on one piano, and I played the piano part on the other piano. We also did two piano work, by the way. We did a lot of two piano works. We did Aaron Copland, the Billy the Kid suite.
Okay.
We did Scaramouche by Poulenc. We did the La Prelude by Franz Liszt for two pianos. He wrote it for two pianos. And we used to practice like 2 and 3 hours on Sunday afternoons and, on two piano. We did a lot of two piano work. We did Brahms waltzes and what have you. Yep.
Well, that must have been wonderful for people to hear.
Well,
did you do concerts with the two pianos?
Well, no, we didn't really. I mean, we may have done. Of course, the two pianos were in her house, and we may have had guests here and there. I suppose I don't remember that we had really put on concerts per se. Of course, soon after that, while I was still in college, she formed this vocal group called of 8 women, and I became accompanist for that. So I accompanied them for about 10 years. That, what I did was accompanying, and so I had a good experience with that also. So accompanying is a field that I'm well acquainted with, accompanying singers and choruses and instrumentalists. It's all kind of stuff I know how to handle.
How did you ever happen to become an organist at the age of 15? How did you happen to be asked to do that?
Well, they didn't have anybody else. The church, wouldn't say it was really noted for its organists and organ playing per se. I remember that the choir did Gregorian chant. They didn't do it well, but they did it because the people in charge were not knowledgeable. They just needed an organist. And at 15, I had only about 3 years of piano study with the first teacher who wasn't adequate. So I arrive on the scene as an organist with having had not one organ lesson. That just shows you sometimes how these churches hire all these people that are totally inadequate. And that happens today, too, by the way.
Well,
can
a person that plays the piano just sit down and play the pipe organ?
Well, you don't use the feet for the pedaling, the pedals down there. I mean, because they play notes down there. I mean, there's a regular... The pedal board is the same as the keyboard on the hand for the hands play. It's arranged in the same manner with the three, like you have your three blacks and your two blacks and your three blacks on the for the hands. You have the same. You have the same arrangement at the bottom there for the feet. And so one could get away with just not using the feet at all, or just using the left foot here and there, and using the hands in a technique. But, of course, the organ and the piano are entirely different instruments. If you have piano literature and you're used to having to use a damper pedal to sustain, there's no damper pedal on the pipe organ. If you take your hands off the keys, the sound is gone.
Can you explain what a damper pedal is, Bill, to people that might not know?
Well, yes. The damper pedal on a piano... There are usually three pedals at the underneath the piano, where used by the foot. The pedal on the right is called the damper pedal, and what it does is the strings of the piano have felt, which is hooked to a mechanism, and the felt, when the felt comes down onto the string, it silences it. That's called dampening the string or dampening the sound. And if you put your foot down on this damper pedal, it lifts all the dampers all across the whole piano, from the bottom of the piano to the top. All the strings are open, so you can play a whole bunch of notes from the bottom to the top in a scale or what have you, and that will just sound without stopping because the strings keep vibrating. And you let the pedal up, and the damper comes down on the strings and silences them. And on the organ, there's no pedal, sustaining pedal of that type at all. It doesn't exist. So the technique on the organ, the only thing that's the same about the organ and the piano is the color and arrangement of the keys.
Well, that's
everything
what I was getting
else.
At. Yeah.
Everything
so
else.
In order to sustain a sound on the organ, you just need to keep the key depressed, and once you release it, that's the end of the sound.
That's right. The sound is gone, except for the acoustics of the building are sustaining it briefly.
I see.
If you have lively acoustics in the building, the sound will be sustained a bit, a few seconds.
What makes for lively acoustics?
Well, that's an area which I have done studies in fact, written papers on it, in fact. A marble sound bounces off marble well. Bounces off well off glass. It bounces off wood to some extent, but some sound is absorbed by wood. Stone floors, the sound bounces off that. If you've got carpeting in a building, it absorbs the sound. If you've got curtains on the windows, it absorbs the sound. And people's clothing absorbs the sound. And the sound is absorbed more in the wintertime in this climate than it is in the summer because people wear fur coats. And fur, the sound gets right into the fur and stays there, believe it or not. So your acoustics. In fact, carpeting on a church floor absorbs 60% of the sound.
Wow, that's
so
amazing.
A church should not have carpeting. Carpeting belongs in bedrooms, not in churches. One of the publishers puts out a little button that says that on it. Carpet churches, carpet bedrooms, not churches. There's a plaque put out by one of the publishers, and that's what it says. If you have good, you don't forget that your European churches, your churches in Europe, none of them have carpeting in them.
Mm-hmm.
Carpeting, but there's no such thing. You know, I mean, when your churches were built in the 1100s, 1200s, they weren't putting carpeting on floors.
Right.
And that is an American thing, and people think that sounds better. Well, it doesn't. Because then it ruins church music, because the music that's written for church is meant to be done in an area of lively acoustics where the sound bounces all over the place.
Well, it's amazing how many churches I've walked into that have carpeting, and I had no idea that it absorbed that much of the sound. That's incredible.
60%. 60%. Yeah, I did research on that, and I wrote a paper when I was in the church. I was in Houston, Texas. I wrote a series of articles for their monthly publication, and one of them was on acoustics.
Well, getting back to your...
Yeah.
Go ahead, sorry.
Well, just when people put padding on seats, too, on the pews, you know, they'll have cushions. Well, that absorbs sound, too.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it makes it more comfortable for the rear end, but... So... yeah.
Well, backing up to your early days as an organist, you were sent away to school to receive some organ training and choral training?
Yes.
Can you tell us
about
that experience?
Well, yes, I will. I had been at the church where I started when I was 15 only 1 year. I was 16, and the pastor of the church wasn't crazy about my way of doing Gregorian chant. And he said, I'm going to send you to the finest school in this hemisphere. It was called the Pius X School of Liturgical Music. Well, Pius X was one of the popes who wrote an encyclical on music in 1903. And in it, he talks about the chant being chant is the oldest form of Western music anyway. Our music system is based on two of the scales of chant. The major and minor scales have come from Gregorian chant. Most people don't know that. And he sent me there, and we I learned to read the old chant notation, which dates from the 900s. The earliest form of music notation was chant, and that was invented in the 1900s by a monk who lived in Italy. His name was Guido from Arezzo, so that's part of what my studies were. I studied chant, and then I studied what's called choral polyphony, that is the Renaissance music of Palestrina, Thomas Tallis, William Byrd, Orlando Gibbons, and all of these names, which are specialties of mine. Those composers.
What does polyphony mean, Bill?
Well, polyphony. All right. Well, it's Greek. Poly means many, and phony means sound. So it means many sounds. And what it means is not just one melody with an accompaniment, but several melodies together at the same time. Sometimes one part imitating another and so on. All right, a simple example of polyphony would be three blind mice. You start, someone else comes in with the same tune, someone else comes in with the same tune still later. A round is a form of polyphony, but a very simple form because quoted each time a new person comes in to sing or a new section comes in to sing is quoted exactly the same as it was. But in polyphony, there will be slight variations that go on in choral writing. But that's just a form of polyphony because it means more than one voice, more than one melody at the same time.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
I figured that most people wouldn't have any idea what
roll
that
your
was.
Roll your boat.
Right.
A form of polyphony. Poly means
okay.
Poly, many, many voices. Well, in this case, it would be, you know, it's quite simplified type, but that's what it is in a sense, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, I studied organ when I was in New York, too, at that Pius X school. And, of course, I'd had a few lessons before I went there. And then when I got back from that school and I got back to Baldwinsville in my hometown, I wasn't happy with my organ teacher anymore because I'd been spoiled by a much finer teacher when I was in New York. It had an influence. I mean, my teacher that I'd had was a local person, and she was not any... not any great guns, let's put it. So all of these things, you know, when you get out into the world and you find out there are a lot of people that know a lot more than you do, and you have a lot of work to do and a lot of studying to do, and I'm still studying.
Mm.
In fact, I'm memorizing music right now. This week.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
I wish I had the capacity to do that.
Well, I have a background of theory. I've studied music composition, how it's put together. And that helps to analyze and helps to memorize, you know, what's going on.
Well, that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
How much longer was it before you had a competent organ teacher once you'd returned to Baldwinsville?
Well, let's see, I returned to Baldwinsville when I was 16, and I didn't have a decent organ teacher till I was 21 or 22. So it was about 5 years or thereabouts when I had started at Syracuse University with Arthur Poister. He was considered one of the two greatest organ teachers at that time, I'm talking about 1950s, in the United States. There were two great teachers in the United States, and he was one of them.
Well, you know, you were very fortunate to have him. That's wonderful.
Well, he was a great teacher. He was very patient, and of course, Hetty Killian was very patient as a piano teacher, and my present horn teacher is very patient, and he makes certain demands, but he's not. It's not unruly or impatient about matters, and it's what I call an excellent teacher. Expect something, but not too much.
Well, on that subject, what makes for a really fine musical teacher, in your opinion?
Well, a good teacher needs to be patient with the students, very thorough. Don't leave any stones unturned. Make sure they understand all that has to be learned. I mean, as far as the music itself is concerned, reading the music, what all the various notes mean, what all the symbols there involve, and whether it's to be loud or soft or get softer or get louder, and what key it's in and all this kind of stuff. He has to make sure. Now, my teacher now, my horn teacher, does things that he doesn't need to do for me because I'm such an old seasoned musician. He does it like I'm almost like I'm, that I don't have much of a music background, and I do. But he teaches me like I don't have much of a music background. But I appreciate that because I know he's being thorough, and I expect that to happen.
Can you give an example of what he might do, William, along those lines?
Well, for example, I'm getting into technicalities about music is concerned here. Like, for instance, he will say, what if there's an S there? What does that mean? I said, well, it means loud. It's the Italian word forte, means loud. He says, all right. And then he will circle the time, what's called the key signature, like if there are three flats, B flat, E flat, A flat. He said, well, notice the key this is in. And I said, yes, I see, it's E flat major. But he doesn't take that for granted. He just automatically does it. And he doesn't, he treats me in the same way that he might treat somebody who was 10, 15 years old.
I see.
And I'm 85. So,
well.
But I don't mind that. Because I know the man is doing his job well. And I appreciate that. And I tell, he said, oh, he will do it, and then he'll kind of apologize. I said, don't apologize. You're doing a good job. I know, that's fine. And I know that some people are insulted when I know that I've had people, when I would do that kind of thing, like, for instance, with a choir, and I would point out things like that, I had people in the choir who said that I was looking down on them. Well, I'm not looking down on them. I'm just trying to be thorough.
Right.
I don't know what they know. I can't read somebody else's mind and say, oh, well, they know what three flats means. I don't know if what they know, unless I've worked with them or something. So he's treating me that same way. He doesn't know what I know. He asked me one day, he wanted me, wanted me to accompany him on the horn, and he showed me the music. He says, is that too difficult for you? And, well, it's simple for me. But he wouldn't know that. So I'm not insulted by his question at all.
Anything besides patience and thoroughness that is important to you in a music teacher?
Well, it doesn't hurt to have a bit of a sense of humor.
Right? Right?
I don't know whether I can think of something offhand right now concerning that about, of course, let me put it this way. a person certainly should be knowledgeable about what they're teaching. Let me give you an example of that. When I was in college, and I was doing my undergraduate degree, part of what we had to have was called History of Music, it was called, and it goes back to, I don't know if it went back to the Greeks. Of course, we don't know actually an awful lot about Greek music anyway, but it did go back to chant, which, of course, we have that notation, and from the 900s, and I do know that this professor of music history was doing something concerning chant incorrectly. Well, he's a professor at the university. He's doing this incorrectly. Well,
so what did you do?
I wasn't going to make a big thing about it in front of other students. I didn't want to do that. So I went to him after the class. And I said, Professor Morris, I said, you know, excuse me for doing this, but I said, you know, that one thing that you were teaching about that chant, you weren't handling that in the proper way. And he said, well, what do you mean? And I explained to him what was wrong with what he was doing. He was giving it the wrong name, for one thing. He was calling it a gradual or something. Anyway, this all has to do with liturgical thing and all this kind of stuff that I'm so well, that I've been trained in.
Right.
And he said, oh? He said, well, he said, look, why, I'll tell you what. He says, would you be willing to teach two classes on chant to the class, to the music history class? I said, well, yes, I'll be glad to do that. He says, well, go ahead. We'll schedule it for next week and the week after then. So I taught two classes. Yeah, that's what happened. So he wasn't thoroughly trained, and then I do recall his comment to me was, well, he says, if I had to know everything there was to know about music, I'd have to be studying all the time. And I felt, I didn't say so, but I felt like saying, well, why don't you start?
That's priceless.
No, I mean, hey, wait a minute. If you're a professor in the university and you've got students that know more than you do.
Right.
And he always was doing something else he was doing wrong about the chant. He was using, because a note was on a certain place on a certain line on the staff, those lines that we write music on, you know, the lines and spaces. He was calling a certain letter name. I said, well, that doesn't have a letter name. Because I said, you're thinking of an instrument, of a musical instrument that will have a letter name like G. You mustn't forget that these people, when they did this chant, there was no instrument around at all. It was done without accompaniment. There was no accompaniment. And it was whatever the voice could handle, you know, whatever the voice could handle, what would be the high note and what would be the low note, what they could handle, and so on. So that has to all be taken into consideration. And, of course, that's one of the things that when I see a piece of music now for choir, for choir people, I have to take into consideration what's the high note and what's the low note, and what would be the highest note a soprano should ordinarily sing without being going to an extreme. You can't expect an ordinary singer in a choir to sing a high note like some opera singer does, who's had a lot of training. Choir
right.
singers don't have a lot of training. They're average voices. So you have to find music that's suitable for average voices. And, of course, that's the beauty of the music of the Renaissance. It was all written with that in mind.
Chant,
you know,
was written for people so that anybody could sing it.
It was written for average voices.
Mm.
I mean, everybody that could sing Yankee Doodle. Well, let me give you an example of a piece of music that we have here in this country is not suitable for the public to sing, and that's why the public doesn't sing it. The Star Spangled Banner.
Mm.
It goes too high. People can't sing that high. Well, when Congress passed that as our national anthem, unfortunately, they were considering probably only the words and not the music.
Right.
Because the music,
right.
You hear every other country in the world, the national anthem, everybody sings. In the U.S., nobody sings, and you have somebody getting on a microphone, usually, and they screech the high notes, and the low notes they can barely produce.
I know what you're saying. Yes,
yes.
I've heard that myself.
So you see, the thing is this, that to get into the technicality of it all, the range of the human voice is what we would call one octave, or eight notes, or do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. And that's it.
That's the normal range, then, one octave?
That's the range of the average voice, yes.
Oh, my. That's not very much.
Very little, maybe one or two notes more on each end, possibly. But that's why,
okay.
For example, your hymns in your hymnals, you very seldom a hymn in a hymnal that goes as anything beyond eight notes. And your Gregorian chants will go eight, nine, possibly ten notes, and never more.
Mm.
That's why the Gregorian chant is written for average voices. And it's considered music for the multitudes, not the elite. The elite
now,
would be like, yep.
When did you start working with the choir, William?
Well, when I took the job as organist at 15, of course, I wasn't doing choir at all. I was just playing the organ, or supposedly playing. I wasn't playing very well because, as I say, I was really not trained to do that. And then after the following year, when I started there at 15, and at 16, I went to New York and studied organ and got back and began to learn some little preludes and fugues of Bach. And so I began to be somewhat of an organist, let's put it that way. Well, mm-hmm. I came back from that school in New York with this knowledge of chant and this knowledge of this Renaissance music, Palestrina and all those composers. But I was 16.
Right.
That choir, they didn't want to have a 16-year-old leading them in something. I was a kid. I didn't start doing really choral work, directing a choir at age of 24, I started directing choirs. So I was 16, so it was 8 years. No, 7 years. 7 years would be, 6 years, wouldn't it be? Or 20, I was 24. 16 to 24, how much is that?
That's 8 years.
Eight years, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes, it is.
8 years. I had studied choral work, and so I began studying or doing choir work when I was 24. However, in the meantime, though, I had gone to two other choral schools because I studied also with Fred Waring. This is beyond Syracuse University in my degree at the university because they didn't have much of a choral department up there to begin with. They didn't have any choral teachers, really, per se. They had vocal teachers, voice teachers who teach people to get into opera and sing solos, but not choral work, per se. And just because you're a vocal teacher and because you can sing doesn't mean you know how to do choruses. That's another technique. Sure. So I studied with Fred Waring, and he was great on English diction and rhythm problems. And then I studied with Olaf Christiansen, who from Minnesota, and, of course, he was from the St. Olaf Choir, and his father, this was Olaf Christiansen, his father, Melius Christiansen, was the first person to introduce choral work into Carnegie Hall in New York.
Oh, my.
And they were Scandinavians. And, of course, Scandinavians are noted for their choral work.
And, I didn't realize that.
Oh, yes. They're very noted for their choral. In fact, there's every year at Christmas time, there's a big broadcast that comes from Trondheim, which is Norway, way up in the most northern Gothic structure in the world. Church in the world is in Trondheim in Norway, and they have always a broadcast from that magnificent building. And acoustics are lively. There's no carpeting in there. There are no draperies in there, and there are no padding on the seats in there. So all these.
Okay.
Yeah, that's. Yeah.
Well, what makes for a good choral director, Bill?
Well, of course, my experience with directing choirs has also been directing children's choirs. I have formed children's choirs. Well, let me just start with that, if I may.
Sure.
I started a children's choir in the school where I taught. They had never had a children's choir in the school. The person they had that taught music there before me was not really well trained, I guess. And so what I did is I auditioned all the children from 4th, 5th, and 6th grades. Now, how I auditioned them was I auditioned them not to frighten them. It was a very simple matter. I would use some song like I would have a class, like I'd have a fourth grade classroom. I'd be in the classroom, and all the fourth graders, and I'd have them sing something that they knew well. Well, My Country, 'Tis of Thee, perhaps, you know, something like that. All of them sing, and I go up and down the rows of pews of students up and down, and put my ear, listen to them. And if their sound was good, if they were on pitch and they had a good sound, then I just touch them on the shoulder. Right? If their sound was no good, I didn't touch them on the shoulder. So when I'd get through doing all that, then I'd have all those, and I'd tell those who I had touch on the shoulder, would you please stand? And then I'd have them sing by themselves. And just them sing. And by that method, I was able to pick the voices. Now, of course, part of the work that I had to do in school, when I taught school, was beginning in first grade, I had to do what was called tone matching, where you try to get those students who can't sing in tune, let's put it, get them to sing in tune. And there is a technique of doing that. Well, that's one of the first things one has to consider in a choir, is that you've got voices that sing in tune, let's put it that way. And then you'll have people will say, oh, well, I can sing anything. You'll have, like, since you'll have a soprano. Oh, I can sing alto, and I can sing soprano. I can sing, well, they can't. They can't.
I was wondering what you do with adults, because when you have a church choir, presumably that's not an audition choir.
Right.
And how do you deal with adults that aren't able to match tones?
I don't think I've ever had that happen. I think that would be a very difficult task. If you had people that didn't sing in tune, let's put it, as adults, it would be a very difficult task to remedy that. It's probably a little bit late to do it, to try to remedy that fact, although maybe it could be done, but it would require one-on-one work, and it might be embarrassing to the person, and to eliminate a person from a choir. There would be some choirs that you audition to get into it to begin with. But when I would arrive at a church, and I don't think I've ever had it happen that I got to a church choir where people would be so bad that I'd have to eliminate them or want to eliminate them, let's put it that way. But I would go, what I do, first, let me say I've got tenors. Let's see, I've got four tenors, all right? And I put these four guys up in front of me, and I have them sing something in unison, something that they know well. You know, I mean, an obvious My Country, 'Tis of Thee, or God Bless America, or whatever. And have them sing it. And then I walk in front of them and listen to them. I listen to what's going on. And I can tell. And then I may have them, I may lower the tune to a lower pitch, so it's this lower sound, and then have them sing and see how low they can go. And then I raise it up and see how high they can go. And then I try to determine if they're really tenors or not. And there's a certain range a tenor should be able to sing. A tenor should be able to sing an A above middle C. If you know about music, you know what that is. If they can't sing an A above middle C, they're not a tenor. They've got to at least go that high.
Okay.
A baritone or a bass should be able to go up to the D above middle C or the E above middle C. That's a baritone or bass. And a soprano certainly should be able to go up to an octave above middle C, to the G above that at least, or A. And an alto should be able to go low enough that they could go to the G below middle C. So you have to determine what's the lowest note and the highest note. So, you know, just you have to listen. You have to listen in. And then place them, for example, when I have a choir where you have people who don't I've gotten into choirs where there are people who couldn't read music. Well,
how do you deal with that?
Well, there's no reason for that to be, because listen, everybody but a fool speaks at least one language. Everybody learns how to read. A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Well, reading to read music isn't any different from reading A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Believe me, it just isn't. It's just another language. I started teaching note reading in grade one, vocally. Well, how do I do that? I have a note reading program for people who can't read music. And some people balk at it. They want to do the old way. It'd be the same thing as if somebody has to learn the first act of some Shakespeare play, and they learn it by not reading it because they can't read. So they learn it by you speaking it to them, and they're repeating it back to you. Well, that's how they want to learn music. They want to hear the tune, and then sing it from having heard it, but not from reading it. Well,
How do you teach people to read music in the context of a choir where there are people that already know how to do that, and then you discover there are people that don't know how to read? How can you accomplish teaching them to do that without boring the other people, or do you single them out and have lessons, private lessons with them?
Well, that can be a bit of a problem. What I would simply do is say anybody who's interested in learning reading music, if they don't read, or learning more about reading music, we're going to have about 10 minutes of note reading at each rehearsal at the beginning or the end of the rehearsal. And if they're interested, they'll get there in time for that. And if they're not, and if we have it at the end, they will stay and the others can just depart. And if they can depart in a quiet manner so you can continue with your work. That's what I would do, and I have done that. And it's a simple matter. It's just a do-re-mi system. Mm-hmm. I just use, you put the notes on the blackboard is how I would do it, and have a pointer, and they would sing do-re-mi-fa-sol, sol-fa-mi-re-do, and you're pointing to the notes as they do it. And that's how I taught first graders. I remember teaching a choir, and when I was in the choir, I was teaching the adults. There was ones that didn't, and one of the singers said to me, one of the altos said to me, she said, "Well, how come you treat us like third graders?" Well, I didn't answer because I wasn't using third grade material. I was using first grade material.
That's precious. So
I was using the same technique that I used to teach children in first grade. Well, look.
Uh-huh.
You don't know something, you're a 5-year-old, aren't you? If someone wants to teach me about something about chemistry, you better pretend that I'm 5. I remember a fellow trying to explain to me something was talking about the atomic energy business or something at a dinner table. And I looked at him, I said, I don't understand a thing that you're saying. Do you want me to understand you? He said, well, yes. I said, I want you to pretend that I'm 5. Now tell me about atomic energy as you were a 5-year-old. It
sound like that's the technique to use with people. I've been in choirs where there are people that don't have the training, and it's very frustrating to be in that situation, and they do need to receive remedial training as I see it. We're starting to run a little short on time. I wanted to ask you Hello?
Oh, I'm here.
Yes,
I wondered what you consider your phone gave out on me.
Okay. Okay.
What's
the single most important job that you've held, Bill?
Oh, most important? Well, I mean, of course, I love teaching school and all that, but I wouldn't do it today. It would be teaching little children, or even high school people might be troublesome today. And college, to me, is not teaching college students. Wouldn't be a challenge for me. They're too easy to teach. I mean, they're too easy in a sense. They're too easy to teach, except they argue. But at any rate, what's the most important job? I would say, of course, my specialty is choral work.
making choirs out of average singers and seeing them learn and see them blossom. I would say the job that I had at St. Mary's in Baldwinsville, which I was there for a total of about 30 years. I would say that was the most interesting.
What was your most significant musical accomplishment while you were there?
Well, we did a Buxtehude cantata. We did a cantata for Advent, but written by Buxtehude, who was the teacher of Johann Sebastian Bach. We did lessons and carols. Of course, while I was there, I was instrumental in having a new pipe organ put in there in 1960. It was installed there in the fall of 1964, a pipe organ that came out of a concern in Canada, St. Hyacinth, Cassavant Brothers, is a manufacturer. And I played the dedication of that in April of 65, and I had timpani and kettle drums and brass. We had trumpets and trombones, and we had a cappella work and accompanied work. And so I decided, you know, most organ dedications are just someone coming in as a guest and playing the organ. I said, no. We're going to show what the organ can do as far as accompanying is concerned, and we're going to have a big program. And so that was a nice program, and it went very well. And so that was, you know, and I had a couple of nice programs in the school where I taught, Christmas programs with the children's chorus. I had 92 in the chorus. 4th, 5th, and 6th grade, every voice audition to get in. They sang in parts.
Wow.
I accomplished that, yeah. So, you know, just... But I love doing choral. I love doing choral work, and I like working with amateurs. I wouldn't work with opera singers for anything. I say I wouldn't. I would work with an opera singer if they'd be willing to sing like in a choral manner. But
and how would they do that?
Singers, pardon me?
How would an opera singer be able to function in a choir? How would they be able to sing in a choral manner?
Well, they'd have to be part of the team, not a soloist.
Uh-huh.
They would have to be. I'll tell you, a good chorister or a good choir singer. A good choir singer, this is the definition. A good choir singer is a person who, when he sings his loudest, is not heard above the rest at all. He subdues himself. Yeah.
William, I'm sorry. We're just about out of time. I wanted to ask you what you would say to a young person who wants to have a musical career.
I would certainly encourage them. And I would not only encourage them, if I was any way that I could help, I would. I don't know that I'd be able to help financially, but I'd be able to help in many other ways. In fact, I've had people in my neighborhood where I live. There was a boy a couple of doors away, and I told his parents, I said, send him over. I'll accompany him, and I'll help him out. Well, they didn't. I didn't hear from them, but I'm very willing when I see young people that might have potential to see that that potential is given the right chance and in the right direction and the right kind of teaching, that they're not wasting their time with people who are not qualified to teach. And, of course, we have a lot of people that are doing that. We have people that are teaching piano that are not qualified to teach. For anybody who wants to be serious about the matter, it's all right if you want to pay T for two, and that's all. But if you want to get
right into
the concert field, you need to have teachers who are adequate. But it's a lot of discipline. It's a lot of work. And, of course, it doesn't happen overnight. As my Hetty Killian said to me at 18, it's too late. And my horn teacher, I was talking with him recently, and he began horn when he was 10, and I said that I wanted to begin when I was 14. He said, that's already a bit too late.
imagine.
Oh, that's remarkable.
I mean, can you think that a lawyer would have to start at the age of 7 or 8 to learn law?
I hear what you're saying. Yeah. Well, we're all out of time, William. I want to thank you for being my guest today. And I have really appreciated your sharing with us. So once again, we come to a close. Now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we're all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There's no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who are having a spiritual experience. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.